Why don't we go ahead and get started? I want to thank everybody, as always, for joining the call. We appreciate it very much. This is the last call of the year for the climate briefing. We're very lucky to have Jim May from Widener University Law School with us today. For those folks who came to the ELI dinner and saw our program live, they would have seen Jim in action, and he filled in as well, which we were very appreciative of. We also, as always, are going to have Kyle Danish and Nikki Roy, who we're grateful to have, as always. There's been a lot of developments this month. Climate change is definitely not dead as a political issue. So why don't we go ahead and let Jim May get started for us on the litigation front.
Okay, thank you, Scott. And good evening and good afternoon to everyone. I'm going to briefly address selected developments in climate adjudication since the last climate change teleconference update. I'll talk about developments before the Supreme Court and also concerning EPA rulemaking, selected Clean Air Act permits, and under the Endangered Species Act. Now, of course, most notably, just last week, the Supreme Court in Connecticut versus American Electric Power agreed to hear a case involving constitutional challenges to common law causes of action for climate change. It's a case that is sure to rock the foundation of climate law and policy. Now, in this case, a collection of states representing nearly 80 million people, as well as several private conservation organizations, sued the nation's five largest emitters of carbon dioxide and the Tennessee Valley Authority, alleging that their greenhouse gas emissions are an ongoing public nuisance under federal or state law. Plaintiffs asked the court for injunctive relief to cap the defendant's emissions, develop a schedule for reducing defendant's emissions on a percentage basis over time, assess and measure available alternative energy resources, and reconcile the court's relief with U.S. foreign and domestic policy. The defendants, on the other hand, contended that federal courts should exercise judicial restraint in resolving questions of high policy, which in the defendant's view are consigned to the political branches. The district court agreed with the defendants and dismissed the case. Last year, however, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit reversed on political question, federal preemption, also known as displacement, and standing ground. First, the Second Circuit held that climate change is neither constitutionally consigned to the elected branches nor prudentially left to them. Second, the court held that federal legislation, including the Clean Air Act, does not displace plaintiffs' federal nuisance claims. And last, the court also held that both the state and non-state plaintiffs have standing to bring the case. The panel's ruling was 2-0. Judge Sotomayor dropped out as she was at the time under consideration for elevation to the Supreme Court. Now, on August 2nd, earlier this year, American Electric Power and other utility defendants filed a petition for certiorari to reverse the Second Circuit's ruling on three grounds: political question, displacement, and standing. In late August, the Obama administration filed a brief too, this time on behalf of TVA, which joined the utility defendants' request for certiorari. In its brief, the U.S. Solicitor General's office, as was discussed in more detail in an earlier call, argues firstly that plaintiffs lack prudential standing under the standard articulated in the First Amendment's Newdow decision, and largely for the same non-justiciability reasons defendants argue in favor of applying the political question doctrine, and secondly, that EPA activities during the last 12 months, including the final reporting rule, the proposed tailoring, cement kiln and light-duty truck emission rules, and other activities, displaced the need for common law causes of action under the standards articulated by the court in the Middlesex and the Milwaukee 2 decisions. Justice Sotomayor has recused herself from this case. That seems to increase the prospects for a potential 4-4 split. Now, prognosticating is a dangerous business, particularly given the amalgam of standing and political question doctrine, supremacy clause, separation of powers, congressional authority, federalism, big business, and the defining issue of our day, coupled with the court's recent penchant for reversing controversial circuit court decisions in environmental cases, particularly out of the Second and Ninth Circuits. So this case makes for strange bedfellows, however, and it could come down to Justice Kennedy's vote. For example, strict textualists might question the basis for the political question doctrine to stem judicial review under Article 3, while originalists might call the Second Circuit's ruling activist. On the other hand, activists might describe a result to overturn the Second Circuit's ruling and to set aside state action as being activist. States' rights advocates might be inclined to uphold the state's lawsuits, except that this is an environmental case involving what some might consider to be progressive state action that often falls when brought before the Supreme Court. This case at bottom, fits none of the justices' ideological templates to a T. And the incoming 112th Congress has already set its sights on blocking EPA action on climate, which informs all three issues. With all of that in mind, it could come out this way: to uphold Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan, to reverse Justices Scalia, Thomas, Alito, and Roberts. The wild card again, on this case, as with so many in the last decade, is Justice Kennedy. If Justice Kennedy votes to uphold the Second Circuit's decision, that could mean a 4-4 deadlock, which effectively upholds the Second Circuit's ruling. But given Justice Kennedy's concurrence in Rapanos, for example, anything is possible, including that a concurring opinion could be paramount. Now, a few words about some related cases. Two related cases to watch over are Comer versus Murphy Oil and Native Village of Kivalina versus ExxonMobil Corporation, which involve the same constitutional questions, except for substituting preemption for displacement in one case and damage for injunctive relief in both cases. In Comer, Fifth Circuit ruled to uphold going forward with the case in an original panel decision. Yet the court, on procedural grounds, reversed that and dismissed the panel's decision and reinstated a district court opinion which had thrown out the case on political question ground. In late August 2010, the plaintiffs filed a writ of mandamus asking that the Supreme Court direct the Fifth Circuit to reinstate the Circuit Court's panel unanimously upholding the case as being justiciable, or remand with instructions to hear the claims. And this matter is likely due to be considered in conference by the Supreme Court in January. The next case is the Native Village of Kivalina case, and in this case, the plaintiffs brought a federal lawsuit against a dozen petroleum refining, energy and producing, and coal extracting companies. The case has been briefed and argued before the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit. Now for a brief update of adjudicative developments in other contexts, including EPA rulemaking under the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act permitting, and the ESA. First, EPA rulemaking. Again, very recently, on Friday, December 10th, just last Friday, in the consolidated case of Coalition for Responsible Regulation versus EPA, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit denied all pending motions to stay EPA's regulations of greenhouse gases, some of which are scheduled, these regulations, that is, are scheduled to take effect on January 2nd, 2011, in just about 2 weeks. The EPA's rule, which takes effect, requires new and modified sources already required to control emissions of other air pollutants to control greenhouse gas emissions for 6 months. And after the six-month period, then new sources with emissions exceeding 100,000 tons a year and modified existing sources with emissions of more than 75,000 tons a year would be regulated. Some motions in these cases, consolidated cases, challenge EPA's authority to regulate industrial greenhouse gases. Others challenge EPA's ability to exempt smaller greenhouse gas emitters. Four conservation groups petitioned to intervene in the case to defend EPA's decision not to exempt emissions from biomass energy activities, and so it goes. The per curiam order by Judges Ginsburg, Tatel, and Brown from last Friday declared that petitioners have not shown that the harms they allege, and I'm quoting, have not shown that the harms they allege are certain rather than speculative, or that the alleged harms will directly result from the actions which the movements seek to enjoin, end quote. The court also scheduled these cases for oral argument on the same day. Now with regard to permits, three quick remarks here. On November 18th, in the Russell City Energy Center decision, the EPA Environmental Appeals Board denied petitions to review a Clean Air Act permit issued by San Francisco Bay. The order gives the go-ahead for the first ever Clean Air Act pre-construction permit issued with limits. On November 30th, pursuant to Wild Earth Guardians versus Jackson, secondly, EPA agreed to respond to Title V petitions objecting to Colorado's issuance of operating permits to three coal-fired power plants. And on December 1st, in the matter of the application of Middletown Coke, the Ohio Supreme Court held that the state law provides the Ohio Power Siting Board with authority to consider environmental impacts. Next, regarding the ESA, on November 24th, and pursuant to the Center for Biological Diversity versus Kempthorne case, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service designated nearly 200,000 square miles of Alaska land and floating sea ice as critical habitat. Under the Clean Water Act, on November 15th, the EPA issued a regulatory guidance memorandum instructing its reasons on how at this point to take account of CO2 contributing ocean acidification in reviewing state lists of so-called impaired waters, that is, waters that don't achieve water quality standards and might be subject to ATMDL. And that's my report. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. That was great. Really very much appreciate it, and we'll have plenty of questions for you in a moment. As a reminder to folks, if you have a question, please do email schang@eli.org, and we'll get those addressed to the panel. Next, let's move on to Nikki Roy for some discussion about legislative issues.
Great, thanks. I'm going to talk just a little bit about the new chairman of the very powerful Energy and Commerce Committee. Again, the House Energy and Commerce Committee has jurisdiction over traditional energy matters, but also environmental matters, including the regulation of greenhouse gas emissions. And this was a very hard. Who was going to be chairman in this in the upcoming Congress? It was a very hard fought issue. Outgoing ranking Republican Joe Barton of Texas, had asked for a waiver on the term limits that the House Republican Caucus imposes on its committee leaders, and also John Shimkus of Southern Illinois had wanted to be chairman, and Cliff Stearns of Florida had wanted to be chairman. From the beginning, the member who seemed to have the inside track was Fred Upton of Southwestern Michigan. The one question was that Mr. Upton tends to be relatively moderate, and I'll describe what that means in a second. But certainly more moderate on a lot of environmental issues compared to Mr. Upton and Mr. Barton and Mr. Shimkus. That there was a movement to keep him from getting the chair because he was too moderate. In recent weeks, as part of his campaign to get the chair, he put out more conservative statements. But I think it's interesting to go back and look at what his record tells us. His website, Mr. Upton's website, continues to call for reductions in carbon emissions, and that's in the first paragraph of his position on energy and environment. He scored 30% with the League of Conservation Voters in 2009, and his annual scores range from 23% to 40% over the last 10 years. Mr. Barton, by comparison, topped out at 5% in 2007. There's an organization called Republicans for Environmental Protection. They have their own scorecard, and they gave Mr. Upton a 56% rating in the last Congress. Although Mr. Upton voted for the Waxman-Markey Greenhouse Gas Cap and Trade Bill, he wrote a 2009 op-ed that called for more nuclear power, carbon capture and sequestration, and renewables because, quote, climate change is a global problem that requires global solutions. There's any number of other votes that he's taken and co-sponsorships that he's done over the years that indicate his, that he is really among the more moderate, has been among the more moderate Republicans when it comes to environmental issues. My sense, all that said, is my sense is that he will have to start off as much a conservative as any of his rivals would have been. That's where the Republican caucus is now in the House, and there are certain promises, explicit and implicit, that people have made about the agenda starting out. But as often happens, opportunities develop later in a Congress, and there we might see some of his moderation kick in. I don't think under any condition, I don't think it's likely at all that we would see anything called a climate bill. Certainly not a comprehensive climate bill, but there might be some energy measures that would be helpful from the perspective of reducing emissions of lots of different pollutants, including greenhouse gases. On the question of who will be the subcommittee chairman, because The Energy and Commerce Committee, it's a large committee. I think in this last Congress it had, I guess it had several dozen members, and so it works. Does a lot of its work through subcommittees. In this last Congress, there's been an energy and environment subcommittee. Mr. Upton has talked about breaking that committee up into two, so one energy and one environment. And that has not been finalized yet. If it does, then obviously he, there's a race for who gets to be the chairman of the subcommittee, and that could be pretty influential in the in this last Congress. For example, Mr. Markey has been the chairman of the energy and environment subcommittee, and Mr. Boucher, who helped write the precursor to the Waxman-Markey bill, was chairman before that. So that can be a very important position, and we should find that out by the middle of this week. And then another important question is how he staffs the committee. And the trade press says that he is thinking of the trade press reports him having actually made an offer to a fellow named Gary Andrus, who is a lobbyist with Dutco Worldwide, who, at least by my reading, I'm not familiar with him personally, but by my reading of his resume, he has had more of a career focus on healthcare than on energy or environment issues. And while I don't think that tells us anything definitive about the committee's agenda for the next Congress, it does remind us that they have other fish to fry, namely, the repeal or at least the revision of the Obama health care bill passed in this Congress. And let me stop there and look forward to any questions.
Thank you, Nikki, very much. That was always wonderful. And next, let's move on to Kyle for an international and perhaps other update.
Thanks, Scott. Report from Cancun. I think the word that we keep seeing over and over again to describe the Cancun outcome is modest. There were modest expectations heading into Cancun and a modest agreement that came out of it, which may be actually a tremendous triumph for the international process for negotiating climate change commitments, which was looking pretty wobbly heading into the Cancun meeting, and utter collapse was at least one possible outcome. It's probably helpful to review the state of affairs as we headed into the Cancun meeting. We'd come off of this tumultuous Copenhagen meeting, which had produced a relatively short accord that charted out some new territory for the negotiations, including some emission reduction or abatement pledges from both developed and some major developing countries, some broad financial transfer commitments from industrialized countries to developing countries. There was, however, all sorts of controversies remaining from the Copenhagen talks, including the fate of the Kyoto Protocol, which has a commitment period that's running out in 2012, and also the nature of some of these emission reduction pledges that were in the Copenhagen Accord, which were fairly voluntary and non-binding, but for which the United States and others certainly wanted to see some form of verification system that would allow a trust but verify type of approach. And the U.S. and China were somewhat at loggerheads after the Copenhagen meeting and had agreed on some vague language there to get through, but this was a continued topic of discussion over the months that followed, and the U.S. certainly seemed to have something of a weakened hand when it did not, the comprehensive cap and trade legislation did not pass in the Congress. So there were modest expectations headed into Mexico. There was a jolt early in the week, or early in the session, I should say, when Japan announced that it had no intention of signing on to a second commitment period under the Kyoto Protocol if it did not have the participation of major developing countries, which brought it somewhat aligned with the United States in that way. There were, week and a half or so of negotiations. They extended it for a day, and then finally announced some results. These results include the following kind of set of agreements. One was to extend any decision about the fate of the Kyoto Protocol until 2011, but with the aim of avoiding any type of gap between the end of the Kyoto Protocol commitment period in 2012 and whatever is going to follow. The U.S. was able to obtain some sort of pleasing language about the level and type of verification that would occur for emissions abatement activities in major developing countries that has to do with a guarantee of some form of international consultations and analysis. I think probably we'll be looking for more detail about what that means, but the U.S. team felt that that was a successful outcome and freed up their ability to sign on to some other agreements, which mostly had to do with outflow of funds and technology from industrialized country to industrialized countries to developing countries. So, for example, the parties took the pledges in the Copenhagen Accord that included a $100 billion pledge by 2020 from all industrialized countries to developing countries, which also includes a fast start of $30 billion by 2012, and they gave a little more language about what that would involve and created a mechanism, a green climate fund that would channel that financing and would have representation of both industrialized countries and developing countries in its governance board. There was also a major agreement on reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation, RED, a policy framework for kind of getting RED activities off the ground, which includes the development of national action plans by some of the key rainforest countries, which will hopefully give, again, some sort of channeling to financing both public and private to address RED. So this set of smallish agreements pulled together gave some basis to proclaim some amount of success in Cancun, albeit modest, but enough to take the parties on to further negotiations next year in Johannesburg for the next conference of the parties. However, still, obviously, a lot of questions remaining. The fate of the Kyoto Protocol remains unclear. It's unclear what the United States has gotten in this further detail about verification rights over major developing countries. There's a question for everybody about how the industrialized countries will fulfill this pretty significant funding pledge. Certainly, it was contemplated for the United States that the cap-and-trade program and the auctioning of allowances would generate the kind of funding that would allow the U.S. to fulfill whatever its part will be of this pledge. Without that, it's difficult to see right now where new sources of money will come from. It seems to me there's a broader question about where the international negotiation process, where this kind of regime is headed. It started with the Kyoto Protocol, very much a kind of a top-down negotiated set of emission targets. At best, it seems to be headed more to a bottom-up approach in which countries come forward and pledge what they are willing to do and then come up with verification procedures and some meshing of financing mechanisms in and around that, but not the kind of targets and timetables negotiation that led to the Kyoto Protocol. That doesn't seem to be in the cards for the next step in these international negotiations. But the process passed its test for now and continues on. That's my report from the international scene.
Thanks very much, Kyle. We appreciate it. It was wonderful as always. The way you describe the potential outcome on the international stage of having a bunch of states saying what they would be willing to do and how it might verify with some linked financing almost sounds like we might end up with the United States de facto absent some federal movement. Did you see any real movement, Kyle, among the United States, China, and India in their core positions, or really no major movement?
Well, again, heading in, there was this major issue about whether particularly the Chinese would agree to some form of external, mildly at least intrusive verification of what they're doing. And it seems as though the United States, working with India and Mexico, was able to come up with a formulation that the Chinese apparently could agree to and that the United States believes moves the ball forward. So that bodes well for continued cooperation, but it's certainly easy for the Chinese to say at this point that their willingness to do very much is cabined by the lack of clarity about what the United States itself is going to achieve, which is requiring the United States to explain what can and will be achieved with these existing tools of policy available in the United States.
Great. And Nikki, has there been any movement on the kind of rock star that we talked about in the past, which would limit EPA's authority to act upon greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act? Is that still alive? Is that still being talked about as something that might get tacked on before the end of this session, or is that pretty much a dead issue?
Well, the trade press seems to think that it's still alive, but I've been told by most people that the assumption is that there won't be time to have a vote on that bill in this session. But I think even if that doesn't happen, people are fairly confident it can come up early in the next year.
Okay. And then, Jim, what's your perspective on whether displacement has really happened? Do you think that there's a significant likelihood that there'll be some traction in the argument that displacement has occurred given EPA's actions under the tailoring rule and having made the endangerment finding, or are EPA's actions not sufficiently broad enough, or are there other Achilles heels in the argument around displacement?
Well, I think, Scott, that's a terrific question, and it's hard to answer at this point because we don't really know what's going to happen with the 112th Congress and how much success they're going to have in stopping EPA from implementing some of these rules. We have the court's decision from last Friday that did not grant the request to stay some of that rulemaking that's at issue on the displacement issue. But as the new Congress comes in and there's increased pressure for particularly the House turning back some of these rules, then I can see that the Obama administration would be in the paradoxical position of having sort of fewer and fewer legs on a bar stool to stand on.
Great. There's a question that's come in asking whether the RED agreement that you talked about, Kyle, is likely to have any effect and really be effective in increasing forest cover.
I think most people that I talk to involved in the RED area say that it's an area where people are closing in on ideas of how to address it, but it will take a few years to get in place mechanisms that people can rely on for these activities. There's very much a move towards getting countries to commit to a certain amount of activities on their own as a basis, before putting in further financing from the outside, which I think is probably the right way to handle it, but it also means that there's going to be a push and pull for a while to define what types of things countries should be able to do on their own and what can be financed by others. It's an area where there's extraordinary promise and people are moving in who are, I think you could say, depending on your view of them, are either pioneers or mavericks. But the need and the potential are so great that I think it's an exciting area, but it'll probably take a few years for the framework to gel. There's exciting work on this going on in California, which is determined to be this kind of, laboratory for making this work, and is committed to trying to get RED crediting into their state program. They got a lot of people pressing forward on this. They've picked a series of states in Brazil to focus on initially, and are trying to develop a framework that would be workable and harmonize with the early thoughts here on the international rules. But again, I think it's going to take a few years to materialize before it can be said to be actually making a difference at scale level.
Interesting. ELI has been involved in Liberia since 2004, the end of the Civil War, and we're actually just had three attorneys come back from spending a month in country in the outside the capital doing training of communities on how the forest laws work there. And we're actually seeing a lot of pushback from the local NGOs about RED. They're actually not supportive of RED following the position of the Friends of the Earth, which has been interesting to try to advise them and advise their government and legislatures to how they might approach RED. So I think you're pointing, Kyle, to something that's very real on the ground, too, that not all the potential recipient countries are going to line up behind this. I want to thank
you guys. Yeah, it's a very local issue. Sorry to interrupt, Scott. Yeah.
No, thank you, Kyle. I just want to thank everybody, as always, for participating in the call. We'll reconvene in the new year. Hope everybody has a wonderful holidays, and thank you particularly to Jim, Kyle, and Nikki very much for your help this year. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.